I was 13 when I received the gift, unexpected and not really understanding the why of it. And had it not been for the giver, that would have been the end of it. You have to understand what being 13 in that time and place meant. I grew up in Gonzales, Louisiana, a small town on the edge of the swamp. Gonzales was the first high ground for 50 miles. This was outdoorsman country, and I embraced it. In the fall and winter, I hunted. In the spring and summer, I crawfished and frogged and fished, and I did play a lot of baseball. And I was a fighter. My mother was a battle axe of a seventh grade teacher. At 13, I found myself in her class of 42 with 9 16-year-old boys. Every punishment meted out by her, and there were many, was visited in revenge on me by those 16-year-old victims of her wrath. My choice was to be pummeled or at the least fight back, though losing was assured. So fight I did. If nothing else, this instilled a visceral loathing of bullies that persists to this day. But the point of this autobiography is to establish the image that at 13, I was a swamper, a bayou savvy tough guy, at least as far as one can stretch that description to a 13-year-old. But about the gift. One more biographical note. I had an older sister, 7 years my senior. She was valedictorian of her high school, a beauty queen several times over, a classical pianist, a summa cum laude graduate of college at 20. So it was that this 20-year-old sister of mine, smart, talented, beautiful, a near goddess in the eyes of this Cajun 13-year-old, gave me the gift. And here it is, 53 years later. William Blake's Songs of Innocence and Songs of Experience for Craig is a book of poetry. Each poem written in my sister's own left-handed script. But what in the world was my sister thinking? Giving me a book of poetry. Horror of horrors. What if those 16-year-old bullies found out I read poetry? Or my friends, for that matter. And who the heck was William Blake, anyway? I looked him up in the Compton's World Book Encyclopedia, which was the source of all worldly knowledge in my home in 1964. He was an 18th century savant, artist, illustrator, engraver, as well as a poet. But most especially, he was a Christian visionary, a seer of angels, a mystic, a person of faith who elevated imagination and emotion over reason and structure. He grasped, as few have grasped, the swirling fog of paradox. Why would my sister have given such a gift to me? I still don't know. However, in spite of who I was at 13, I read those poems, and read those poems over the ensuing decades, and still read the poems. And over the years, they have provided a perspective from which elements of belief and faith have been shaped. Let me illustrate. A Song of Innocence, the Lamb. Little Lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly, bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. He is called by thy name, for he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb, we are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee, little lamb. God bless thee. As a Christian romantic, the purity, the simplicity, the beauty, the sublime imagery of this innocent and profound question and answer has provided to me a place, an emotional and spiritual way station in life's journey, where I could envision a profound peace and embrace a hope in the goodness of it all. I, a child, and thou, a lamb, we are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Yet, there were other songs in the gift, songs of experience. The tiger. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain, and what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil and what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forest of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Life happens. A trio of high school friends dead in a car accident. An aloof but caring father gone too young. A peer brought home in a flag-draped coffin. Friendly fire, they said. Young love and marriage gone wrong. And so much more. So much more. Why the loss, the pain, the injury, the struggle, the death? Tiger, tiger burning bright in the forest of the night. Did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? The Oxford Dictionary defines paradox as the following: a statement or proposition that, despite sound reasoning from acceptable premises, leads to a conclusion that seems senseless, logically unacceptable, or self-contradictory. As one modern philosopher has phrased it, you Christians say, God is omnipotent, God is wholly good, and yet evil exists. There seems to be some contradiction between these three propositions, so that if any two of them are true, the third would be false. The problem of evil poses a question of rationality. Or to bring it closer to home, after David Gushee's Christmas Eve sermon, my older daughter, visiting for the holiday and willing to join Dad at church, asked it this way: if God created everything, then did God create evil? If so, then what kind of God is that? We spent a short time that afternoon discussing her question, but there was not enough time, and as the need to end the conversation was on us, I heard myself saying something like this: Katie, I can lay out several scholarly positions, but in the end, for me, it comes down to fate and a paradox unresolved by reason. Maybe look at it this way: if there is no God, the issue is moot. Maybe we try to be the best people we can be, or maybe we don't try to be good at all. We just are and do. And whatever any of that means, and it means a whole lot of different things to different people, that is that. Eat, drink, and be merry if you can, for tomorrow you die. Or we can acknowledge that we don't know how it all fits together. Some things remain a mystery, and in my language, a paradox. Now we see in a glass darkly. But Kate, with that said, I believe that God is good. that God cared about us enough to be born into our sin and die into our sin. God overcomes that sin and death in Jesus by a life we emulate in the here and now as Christians, and by a resurrection in which we believe in faith and hope that saves not just us individually, but the whole of creation. And while living in this mystery, this paradox between a good God and an errant, often even moral, evil world, we allow ourselves to be embraced by and live into that love of God. With that, she was quiet, and I was quiet, and we moved back in the mix of our family activities. Back in 1981, during the missing and murdered children tragedy, I was offered a job to open an abandoned city-owned community center in the Home Park neighborhood to get kids off the streets and into safe, supervised activities. I took the job and in so doing became an associate pastor at 10th Street Methodist Church. As noted earlier, a key part of my life has been the sport of hunting. I was surprised to find in that congregation a small core of men who had bonded around the Georgia tradition, only one step less sacred than college football. Deer hunting. I was not a deer hunter, but they cajoled me at every turn to take up the activity until, in a moment of weakness, I agreed to go with them. It proved one thing. I am the worst deer hunter ever. One year after I mistook a 10-point buck for a dog and let it pass by, they presented me with a notebook of cutout pictures from various magazines, clearly labeling pictures of dogs and deer for my continuing education. Well, over the years, the lands we hunted were turned into subdivisions, and church members moved on in life, leaving only one other member and me as the remaining deer hunters. The other's name was Jug Harris. He was 25 years my senior, became my best friend and a second father to me. By 1998, we didn't have a place to hunt, but somehow Jug found the lease in South Fulton County along the Chattahoochee River. However, this was different. This was the big leagues of deer hunting. As such, we were introduced to something altogether new: food plots. Apparently, according to this new cast of hunters, deer did not have enough to eat out in the wild, having only survived several eons on their own. So large swaths of fertile river bottom had to be plowed and planted with all manner of crops just for the deer. Food plot day arrived in the spring of 1998, and Jug and I showed up for the planting. I had no idea what to expect. It was a shock. About 7 or 8 areas, each the size of Kansas, had been plowed. There were pickup trucks loaded with bags of seed. We were to take these 50-pound bags over our shoulders, then operate some kind of crank-turn spreader we hung around our necks, and walk across these fields spreading seed. Being impertinent, I asked if the same guy who plowed all this didn't have some type of contraption he could hook behind his tractor with a pokey thing on it that could plant the seeds. I received a condescending smile, and off we went, like a troop of city corner organ grinders. Except that Jug had been diagnosed with colon cancer, so he drove the truck, carrying the remaining bags of seed. As we walked across those fields that day, I did take the time to notice some of the people engaged in this ludicrous activity. 4 of them stood out. One of them, who I will call Fred, because that was his name, was a giant of a man. He was in his early 40s, about 6'4", 240 pounds, all muscle, not an ounce of fat. A man's man, as ever there was one. With him were 3 boys, late teens to 20 or so, who were equally hale and fit. And what a joy it was to watch the interplay among them, Fred included. There was never a moment's break from the kidding, laughing, pranks, taunts, and general juvenile behavior that is de rigueur when men will be boys. Somewhere between the fields, as we were reloading our crank machines and taking on new bags of seed, I remarked to Fred how proud he must be of his sons. He assured me he was very proud of them. But one of the three young men was not his son. He mentioned something about the boy's broken, dysfunctional home, the young man being a friend of his son's, some trouble with the law, and how a year and a half ago, Fred and his wife had taken him into their home. It had filled a big hole in their lives, and what a blessing he was to them. The conversation ended there as we returned to the organ grinding task at hand. But when we finished the last field, I climbed into the bed of Fred's pickup to ride back to camp. As I sat down on the side, I noticed underfoot something strange. There was a huge pile of small sticks, each stick about the diameter of a small straw, each about 4 inches long, bundled in groups of 10 or so, held together by a rubber band. They were everywhere. As everyone in the choir knows, I try to miss no opportunity to make some kind of sarcastic remark or three about any anomaly. And so in this case, playing off of all the teasing I have witnessed and without looking at anyone, I picked up a handful of those bundles of sticks, held them up and said to anyone who would listen, "I'm not sure I want to ride in this truck. This guy is bizarre. He goes around picking up little sticks, wraps them a few at a time in a rubber band, and then throws them in the back of the truck. How weird is that? Does he try to smoke them? Just look at all of them." And I kicked a bunch of them around with my muddy boots. It was only then that I looked over at Fred to see what kind of reaction I would get. I immediately knew something was terribly, terribly wrong. There that giant of a man stood, tears coursing down his dirt-encrusted face. Somehow I had said or done something hugely egregious. But I didn't have a clue. I started to speak, but Fred pulled out a handkerchief and waved me quiet as he wiped his face. He said it was okay. I didn't know. A 16-year-old daughter, her first car, a wreck 2 years ago, a child lost. She loved daisies, and each Sunday after church, he and his wife would take the dozen daisies they placed on the church altar each week and drive to the cemetery. The stems of the daisies were too long for the little vase on the headstone, so he would cut off the bottoms and throw the ends in the back of the truck. There, being crushed beneath my muddy boots, was a testament to a love and a sadness that was limitless, timeless. Over the ensuing years, I cannot tell you how many times I've thought of Fred, of his daughter lost, of rubber band wrapped daisy stems, of a son found, of grief, of church and altars, of life and joy, of songs of innocence and songs of experience, of good and evil, of belief and of faith. Fred taught me a lot of things that day. He taught me about grief. Oh, how he grieved. 2 years later, the tears were still as quick and fresh as the day that child of his had died. There was no sugarcoating, no sop about another angel that God wanted, no beautiful rose plucked to please some officious deity. He had lost, and it hurt, and it still hurt, and it would always hurt. And who knows the self-questioning, the doubt, the anger, the despair that attended that hurt, sacramentally repeated every week as a father and mother knelt to remember what once was and would never be again in this life on earth, their beloved daughter. Fred wept. And still wept. But you know what? I believe so does Jesus weep with him. Every single tear. Every tear. And yet, though the fig tree should not blossom and there be no fruit on the vines, though the yield of the olive should fail and the fields produce no food, though the flock should be cut off from the fold and there be no cattle in the stall, yet I will exult in the Lord. I will rejoice in the God of my salvation. You see, Fred taught me something about worship that day. Each Sunday after church, he said, Flowers from the altar, he said. Somehow within the midst of that loss, in the face of that tiger burning bright, he continued to find the heart, soul, mind, and strength to worship the God of all creation, the author of all life, a good God, a loving God, a grieving God, a comforting God, a resurrected God. That was not some false, pious worship, but a worship born of suffering and hope, a worship deeply infused with another song, the song of faith. Fred taught me something about life that day. He responded to loss with love, not seclusion or rejection. After the planning and after the tears, we were resting, drinking Cokes. Jug and I were talking when a disturbance interrupted us. Fred and those three young men were in a huge tussle. And knowing the ways of men turned boys, I knew instantly what had happened. The young men were complaining about being tired, and Fred had chided them, boasting that he was twice their age and he could still take them on three at a time. And they could not wrestle him to the ground. And so they tried. And the dance was on, the dance of life, embracing one another in the playful abandon of joy and trust and love. And Fred taught me a new song that day, a song of faith. I can't and I don't think anyone could explain away or completely drown out the song of experience he will hear for the rest of his days on earth. His lovely daughter, the light of his life, was gone. Yet somehow, in worship and unconditional love, he also composed as a counterpoint the song of faith, the dominant melody in his life, the paradox of good and evil, resolved by the Lamb of God. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. So I've wondered, did William Blake do us right? Or did he leave his poetry only two-thirds done? Could there have been a third collection of poems, ones we call songs of faith? Or maybe, just maybe, it is up to each of us to write those poems, as did Fred, with the day-to-day honesty and fidelity of lives lived to the glory of God, even in the face of those tigers burning bright in the forest of the night. I never hunted those food plot fields. I never went back. I couldn't. My best friend, Jug Harris, my adopted father, would die of that colon cancer in September 1998 for a season the tiger burned too bright. And yet faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Jug always wanted to know what heaven was like. I was his Sunday school teacher, and he always wanted me to teach about heaven. And I would say, Jug, I can't describe heaven. Who knows what it's like? But now I believe that Jug knows the answer to his question. He knows what heaven is like. And for us who still live in the paradox, our prayer is that it has been for lo these many years, a prayer for resolution. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. This sermon perhaps should have had something to say about our preparation for welcoming a new spiritual leader into this pulpit and into our hearts and lives. I have not done that, but I've tried to answer a question for each of us. What kind of church will David Jordan step into? The way I see it, it's the kind of church with people just like Fred. I know many of your stories. There are many of you who have grieved long and deep without shame or pretense. And yet, you are a people who worship the God of resurrection with all you are and ever will be, who love and give and forgive and receive and enjoy the love of others, and whose faith honestly confronts the paradox, who believe and proclaim it honestly and forthrightly. I believe. but who with all sincerity and humility also pray, help me with my unbelief. That is a church I know and love. What a beautiful place to be. Almost heaven. David Jordan is coming to that kind of church. Little lambs, God bless thee and me. Amen.